Hi, this is Dr. Taylor Capozzello, and you're listening to NeuroNoodle Network Podcast.
Welcome to NeuroNoodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring neuropsychologist Dr. Laura Janssens, Dr. Skip Wrenn, neurofeedback legend Jay Gunkelman, and welcome to the show as guest host, Santiago Brand from Singapore. It's just a shade over midnight over there, right, Santiago?
That's correct, yes, sir.
A lot of coffee. Hey, this is an all-star cast that are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. My name is Pete, and today we have a special guest, Dr. Taylor Capozzello from Elite Physiology. But before we start, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking, Tour Talk, Alternative Behavioral Therapy, EEG and Me, Sadia M, Jonathan Rowe, and January Terrell, and welcome new supporter, Loretta T. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that has been around for 15 years. Tour Talk wants more people to discover Texas speech. Joshua M. at Alternative Behavioral Therapy, Neurofeedback Service in Vancouver, Washington. If you're out that way, get a nice cap on your head out there. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the word out. If they can't hear us, we can't help them. Okay, again, welcome Santiago to the team. He'll be pitching in from the other side of the world where, again, it's late at night. We appreciate him joining us. Santiago, you've been on with us before, but the new listeners could use a little background on you again. Could you please let us know a little bit about you, Santiago?
Sure. Yeah, I've been in the field of neurofeedback for 13 years now. And I am, as I like to call myself, a glorified technician, which means that throughout my career, I have what little I have accomplished has been done through hard work as opposed to advanced degree and smarts. I had the good fortune to be mentored by Jay for the last 10 years, and I think that's what's been pivotal in my success in this field. And I'm very happy to be here with the team and very happy to share my first one with Taylor.
Oh, well, thanks again for joining us, Santiago.
And we shouldn't feel too badly about him describing himself as a tech. I'm a tech. So, you know.
A tech legend, Jay. Ah. I know how you like that. All right.
Only in your mind, you know.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Taylor from Elite Physiology. Dr. Taylor, please give us your background.
Well, you know, my background actually is through body work. So I was a massage therapist for 18 years, and I kept seeing similar patterns in people for breathing. And I got into biofeedback through Dr. Eric Pepper. And that is kind of my background of coming in was through biofeedback, realizing that things I could work on people over and over again for massage, I could fix them. And 2 weeks later, they came back with the same issue. And then as soon as we did biofeedback, I, you know, placed some sensors on them and they learn in 5 minutes and things were life-changing. And so it started my path that way, which then led me to neurofeedback as well.
And when did you get started?
Well, you know, I was introduced to it maybe in as early as 2005. And then I actually started doing biofeedback in 2012.
How did you start with your practice? Was it HRV or how did you introduce it?
You know, really it was muscle biofeedback. That's really what got me into it. My undergrad, I started looking at plantar fasciitis, which is with people having issues with their feet tension. And as I started doing studies on that, I realized that it was from their pelvis tilting and their breathing changing. And then into my doctorate work, I got into looking at that even further alongside while I was doing other EEG things, but really breathing changes the brain, that heart rate, you know, it's really strong and it has an effect on the brain. And, you know, working top down and bottom up is, I personally found to be a really great approach.
What symptoms have you been able to train? Because we get a lot of moms and dads, you know, parents that listen to the show, and there's various symptoms that, you know, pop up that they use, you know, biofeedback and neurofeedback. What have you seen? What is your own personal efficacy that you've seen in your practice for symptoms?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing I do see a lot actually for panic attacks and anxiety, because that so correlates one with the brain and with breathing. So we do neurofeedback and breathing biofeedback every single session, as well as stimulation technology. And all of those things start to rewire a person and train them. And they're, you know, sent home using the breathing biofeedback tools that I give them. I usually send them home with an app for them to practice with that I can track as well, seeing how it's going. And it's, you know, the body will start changing the brain and the brain will start changing the body. So panic attacks, anxiety, ADHD, of course, everybody in our field, that's like a really great, easy one for it, that it can work for. I keep getting a lot of really hard cases thrown at me, but you know, and they take a little bit more finesse and, you know, kind of going down a couple different rabbit holes to figure out. But when, you know, it comes to those, anxiety and ADHD, that's the the nice straightforward ones.
And then, you know, with COVID coming around or Omicron now, what are there any other, certainly doesn't help with the anxiety. Do you see any other symptoms that are popping up?
Yeah. I mean, as Jay's mentioned in other podcasts, really staying awake. So everybody's pretty drowsy all the time. Their vigilance system isn't as alert. And then we have signs and symptoms of ADHD or other things like that, that come along with it, you know, so we stabilize their sleep through, you know, increasing the sleep spindle, as well as having them check other ways that they can improve it, you know, through electronic use and stuff like that.
Santiago, you're in Singapore. Do you see anything? What are the symptoms like there with COVID or Omicron? Is it popping up there? Has it burned itself out? What's it like over there?
No, it's very much like Taylor was explaining. The first thing that I've noticed is that sleep has been highly impacted in most of the population. It's interesting because as far as I know, Singapore is the most vaccinated country in the world right now. I think our vaccination rate here is about 98%. And as of February 1st, it's mandatory. So, you know, if you don't want to get vaccinated, you don't get to go to the office here or go to a shopping mall or go to a restaurant. And I think this is going to push up the vaccination rate as close to 100% as possible. But from a cultural perspective, I've noticed being here in Asia for the last year now that there are certain intricacies to the culture in terms of anxiety management. And people here tend to be a little bit more easily frightened as opposed to the West, meaning US and Europe. And therefore, the anxiety levels here are much higher. You know, even though we're highly vaccinated, people who are getting it are getting mild symptoms, the hospitalization rates are low, people are still very anxious and they're not sleeping well. And what they come here is with symptoms of depression, symptoms of anxiety, poor sleep. And it's all through the neuroinflammation the stress is causing. And I think that doing everything online for the past couple of years has had a high impact on people's brains. You know, going through to school through Zoom, doing meetings through Zoom, working from home, and everything is done online. I think that's wreaked havoc in people's brains. And you know, every time I run EEGs, I tend to see a lot of you know, very slow or very fast baseline rhythms for the most part. It's either or. There's nothing in the middle. I don't know if that's been your experience, Taylor, but that's what I have been observing here.
And then Taylor, I was pointing out that cat back there. Jay and Santiago, you guys have a little connection to Korea and Las Vegas. Jay, did you finally get that dry sensor cap from the iSync guys?
Yes, and I, from basically never having touched it before, when I took it out of the case, I had to charge it, but as soon as it was charged, it took me about two for my first ever sample recording, which I posted on Facebook as a short video clip. Just the sample screen is like, you know, maybe 30 seconds of waveforms. And when you put it on and all the impedances are green and, you know, I don't have to do anything, it's, just click start and it did a nice job showing sample EEG, very nice and clean. You know, I was watching the EEG go by, so there's a lot of lateral eye movement. But other than that, the record is clean. If I would have been doing it as a demo, I probably shouldn't have been watching the EEG go by. But it was quick, it was easy. It gave really nice results, and the analytics are concordant with the prior wet sensor EEGs that I've had done. And I've had EEGs done over the years so many times, I can tell you what my EEG looks like before I even record it. So, and I did for the documentary that they shot on me. They came into the room with a, surprised me bringing an amplifier in, asked me what my EEG would look like. Then they recorded me. Then I analyzed it live on camera. So I have to say that the documentary has taken a rather interesting twist with international film festivals. The London Film Festival has it nominated as the number one documentary or something like that, the best director. It's got four nominations at the film festival going in, you know, before they've actually shown anything. So that's kind of interesting, you know. But we'll see. I think they sent it into maybe a dozen.
Skip, before I get to you, real quick, Santiago and Jay, you had an experience with that cap. Is it possible? Because one of the hardest thing is to train a tech to figure out the right spots to put the sensors and whatnot. Can you really just pop that thing on and you'll get the right placements on everything?
Yeah. Well, you can't just sit it on the back of your head. You know, I mean, you got to sit it on, you know, the frontal electrode should be, you know, in the spot where you expect the frontal electrodes to be. But, you know, it expands out to be bigger and it compresses down to be smaller. And all the electrodes stay in the appropriate 10-20 position. There's little gears and levers and springs and everything inside of it. It's really well engineered. You put it on, center it properly, don't have it tilted to one side or the other, and you're up and running. I've seen it have electrode impedance issues only a couple of times when I've seen it being demoed. And it wasn't, you know, they grab a piece of it and kind of move it around to get the hair kind of parted out of the way. They have a little control that says vibrate that can give things a little buzz to get the little tips to go down through the hair a bit better. But I've yet to see anybody have difficulty with the hookup. It's quick, it's easy. And again, unless you're just kind of trying to do it wrong. I mean, if you got you don't put it on tilted like a, you know, like a chapeau in France or something, you know, set it on square, set it on so it's, you know, low enough to the front so it's not just on the back of your head, and you're up and running. For very young kids, you have to actually extend the electrodes. There's a little tool that comes with it. You can pop the electrodes and extend them out so you can get to a smaller size head. But unless you've got a really small head, a normal adult or a teenager, the standard setting electrode length is fine. And the electrodes stick out about this far from the actual helmet. So if you've got, you know, hair, it has the ability to be stuck down through a fairly thick head of hair. So I'm extremely impressed with the quality of the recording. I've seen a lot of dry sensors that, you know, all the way through the electrode recording. You're going to pop over here, you pop over there. The electrodes are unstable. And this keeps everything held in place really nicely. It did a beautiful recording.
So one size fits all. I've seen pictures of it. How much does this thing weigh, Jay? Approximate.
I don't know exactly what it weighs. It's not inconsequential, but it doesn't feel like you've got a barbell on your head or anything, you know?
So nothing that would invite like neck tension or anything like that.
No.
Okay.
Not at all. I found it to be rather comfortable, and after a minute or so of wearing it, you forget it's there.
You
feel a little bit of the pressure from the electrodes at first, but then after a couple of minutes, you just forget it's there, and it's very comfortable to use. Very, 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 very light.
You ever wear it out in public just because you forgot to take it off, Santiago?
It has a little bit,
but that could happen.
It has a little bit of a Star Wars trooper look to it.
I was thinking Rick Moranis, Spaceballs, right? Big helmet, I think his name was. Taylor, in kind of piggybacking what Santiago brought up and just culture, you're in the Bay Area, correct? San Francisco?
Yeah.
So just general question, but I mean, geez, we say pandemic, like it's one thing. It's been a couple years and it's like this, you know? So my question to you is, how has, California and Bay Area policies affected what you do? And I'll tell you, up in Alaska, March of 20, I guess, we stopped doing neurofeedback just because, people in the same room, hands on heads and all that stuff. And so that's how it impacted us. We're still kind of trying to work our way back in. But so the question back to you is, like, how has that impacted? What have you done to kind of manage policies, which are pretty strict, right? No judgment, but they're strict there, stricter than other places for sure.
Yeah. As basically we're in mental health. And so there's, we were able to go back in person a little sooner. So I'd say it was the 3 months that we weren't allowed to be in office in person. And so during that time, I did a lot of breathing biofeedback on Zoom, and I debated if I wanted to switch to virtual for neurofeedback. But honestly, I really love stimulation technology, and most of that you can't do virtual. It's a little harder to send some of those units, or not, legal. So they have to come in the office. So I just had to work with having enough things in here, like air purifier, something, air conditioner that pulls the air out of the room, having, all the filters and things like that. So it hasn't been too bad. Definitely, like right now with the pandemic picking back up again, a lot of people are taking breaks. But then I'm using it more time. Right now getting ready to start using ERPs into my practice. So I'm using the extra time that I have to get that all set up.
There you go. Good deal. I'm actually going to ERP, mini clinic tomorrow and Saturday with Michael Cohen, for anybody that might remember Mike from past shows, but I'm going to do some ERP stuff this weekend, but I'll give you back to everybody else here.
Well, ERPs are a wonderful pairing with EEG. Actually, the ERP is more considered diagnostic. If you look up ERP and diagnosis, you end up with a big, big list. QEG and diagnosis, not so much. The QEG is very sensitive, but not very specific. So you don't get diagnostically specific, categorization with it. But you get great guidance as to how to treat. You can track treatment outcomes. The QEG is very, very useful, but it's not the diagnostic metric. But then diagnosis isn't really what I'm all eager to be doing anyway. So it's right up there with name calling in my book. So, it's categorization for administration, but it doesn't really tell you how to work. So the QEG and the ERP end up being a wonderful match together.
Jay, real quick, what makes the ERP so much better at diagnosing? And I think we're all in the kind of same camp here with that not being our objective, but it's necessary.
Well, it's basically the applications that have been done with it over the years are more oriented towards diagnostic specificity. Actually, Yuri Kropotov has a nice neuromarkers and psychiatry book. His second book is actually really quite good at identifying primarily ERP biomarkers. There's some EEG in there, but it's primarily ERP biomarkers.
I was trying to pay attention to Taylor, then I saw Jay messing around with his little cap there. What do you got going on, Jay?
Well, you can see the inside of it. The electrodes, if you expand it out, you can see the electrodes in the front split apart, stay proportionate. As this sets on your head, and again, it gives you a little bit of a Star Wars trooper look, but it keeps all the electrodes in the proper location, and it's quite flexible. It looks like it's like one big solid piece, but it's all individual little segments that are all hooked together that end up expanding and contracting and keeping the electrodes in the appropriate 10-20 sites.
Man, the only thing that's holding that thing back is 25 grand. But I think eventually, you know, I'm seriously looking at that because that would really speed up the tech train in time.
Yeah. People look at the purchase price, but if you run a medical office, you look at the medical lease rate. What's your monthly payment going to be as opposed to what's the total? You take out a cash flow, you don't take it out of a capital account. So maybe $700-$750 bucks a month for a 3-year lease. You know, it's about 28,000. Yeah. But it also has photobiomodulation. There's LEDs in the center of each of the electrodes. You end up with a photobiomodulation at each of the sites, and you can program that between 1 and 45 hertz. It not only does EEG recording, it does photobiomodulation treatment, and they're setting it up for neurofeedback as well. So I think it's a rather advanced approach. The thing that they're using it for clinically in Korea now with Korean FDA approval, because of the science behind it, they've got very good publication. If you're my age, 72, and you know, you think, well, gee, my memory is not so good today. You know, I better go see the doctor and see what's going on. When you walk in the door to the doctor's office with your first complaint of something's wrong, doc, what's going on? It could be senior with depression. It could be dementia. It could be lots of things. And it could be just normal aging with some concern. And this helmet stuck on your head for 10 minutes gives you a differential identification. What's the likelihood that you have dementia versus mild cognitive impairment and normal aging? That's a major clinical identification. Imagine somebody coming into the doctor's office. You can plop this on their head in the waiting room for 10 minutes, and you get the result. By the time they see the doctor, you got the test results. You know, some people say, well, I don't want to send my data to Korea. It's not Korea. They have a cloud server. It doesn't go anywhere. It goes everywhere. It's a secure cloud server, so you don't send your data anywhere specific. It's all on a cloud server with AI processing, and they de-artifact the data. You can see the data with artifact or without artifact. You can change the artifacting if you want manually. It's a pretty advanced approach.
I was going to say, maybe we need Elon Musk in on this, and you can have it as a self-driving car. Put the cap on, and when you're in your alpha, your car moves. When you're not, that's better neurofeedback.
Brain-computer interface, brain-car interface, huh? There are actually older devices that have been used with truckers to monitor for drowsiness using brain activity. You can identify when somebody's starting to slip a little bit in their vigilance and give them a little warning. Hey, you're getting a little bit too drowsy. And if they pop back and stay awake, that's fine. But if, if the warning continues, they basically are told they should pull over. So anything that avoids a truck head-on collision with me is a good idea, you know. So
hey, does anyone know, anyone on our panel know if there is other kinds of neurofeedback that are more mechanical in nature? I mean, when we do our neurofeedback, you know, it's movies, it's games, it's things on a computer screen, but, you know, I was joking, but I was curious, has anyone developed anything like that where there's actual something moving in the environment, some kind of mechanical device, a toy, a robot? You know, you, I know that with, you know, working with OT and phantom limbs and things like that, you know, there's all sorts of equipment that's being developed. But I was just wondering if there's other, anyone know of any other kind of mechanical device used with neurofeedback? Because that would be pretty cool to have something three-dimensional.
Yeah, actually, John LeMay, Dr. John LeMay, he developed a way of kind of flying,
like a model airplane?
Not flying, just like, what are they, like a toy plane or a drone, yeah. Doing brain modulation with it. So
oh, that's cool.
He has a patent, it's not released, but you know, you can ask him about
okay,
it.
Okay, not a patent yet. Okay, we're on it.
No, he has it patented. So,
he does, yeah. Okay.
But he did develop it.
Okay, all right.
We'll bug him to make him do something with it.
Yeah, okay.
There's a group of people in Europe, as well as the Koreans and myself, that did a research project that was published in a major journal with a big impact factor. And basically what it was is the ability to prove that real-time de-artifacting could actually work without damaging the underlying signal. So that people walking or running, doing a task, up and moving around, if the EEG is being recorded in those kind of conditions, you can actually take out the artifacts that are induced by the walking, the running, the playing golf, the whatever it happens to be. And we try to do the published proof before we end up seeing the I've got something to sell you. And although that's not very common in the neurofeedback world, there's a lot of, I whipped this up in the lab and I'm selling it today. And there's no publication showing outcomes and stuff. So I've been very appreciative of the Koreans' approach of publishing a positive outcome research to support their, that they're bringing something to actual market. I think they're doing it right as well as anybody can.
That cap, if you're paying a tech $20 an hour to train, I would think, I was making light of the $25,000 or $28,000, whatever it is. You pay that much for the cap, but then you don't have to pay the training hours to the tech or as much. Is that right?
Probably. I mean, I don't know that it takes a whole lot of skill to put this on. I put it on myself, you know. I mean, and first time with no impedance problem at all, and a clean recording immediately. It took me more time to fill out the name and age, my date of birth. It's one of those things where you have to scroll to the year you were born. I scroll halfway to forever with those darn things, you know. So it took me more time to fill out that form than it did to put on the cap. Or put on the wave, so it's awfully easy, and there are going to be people that are difficult with it. If you come in with a huge amount of hair, there are people that come in with weaves and dreadlocks and hair that's done up on top of their head real high or something, that's going to be difficult. If they take their hair down, this wouldn't be difficult for Taylor. This wouldn't be difficult for Laura, but you can imagine somebody's hair that's, dreadlocks or something. That's going to be a difficult one. But like, that's not difficult with paste on discs, even, you know, or an electro cap or any other kind of cap. There are people that have difficult circumstances to record because of hair. I'm not one of them. So I can get back to C3 and C4 and not even mess up my hair, you know? So
Santiago, would you need a tech for to put this cap on? I mean, you were just out there. What do you think?
Well, I think it depends on how you personally want to run your operation. But what I do have to say is that this device is really a game changer. And, you know, we look at the device, that's just a byproduct of, as Jay was saying, the years and years of research they have put into this. You know, I had the personal privilege of spending a full day with them in their facilities in Seoul. And, you know, they're showing me how they do the research. They have a full team of engineers. I'm talking 10 to 12 engineers running the algorithms, extracting the biomarkers from the raw data. And they have another team of engineers doing other fancy stuff with their computers. So you can tell that they're doing the due diligence and, you know, doing the step-by-step procedure and to get to the final product, which is the helmet. And to me, this is a game changer. And again, you know, you could see by looking at the device that it took some time for them to finally come up with this design. You know, when I sat down and asked them, how long did it take from the conception, you know, the vision in your mind to the final design? They said, oh, it was probably 5-7 years before we finally had something ready to market, which is what Jay was just showing us. And I think, in my opinion, you know, I'm getting my hands on one of these. It's going to change the way I run my practice, and it definitely is going to change the way I monetize my work. It will be a game changer for any other practitioner out there, I think.
You know, there was a group that went out to the Midwest to work with the football players and Canton. And they had to do recordings, and if you're pulling somebody out of their normal training routine, it actually disturbs their team training and teamwork. So if you pull somebody out for an hour worth of testing, because it takes you 20 minutes, half hour to hook them up, and another 10-15 minutes to get them cleaned up when they're done. And then they have to go take a shower after that to get rid of it all. That's really disruptive to their procedures. A 10-minute scan with the wave that you put on a head in a couple of minutes. Now I have to say that there's some NFL players that are going to have some difficulty because of hair. You can see some of them have their helmet kind of puffed out with whatever they've got on top of their head, but it's still a way to save time.
Jay, you kind of referred to this, differential diagnosing, and so my day job as a neuropsychologist is all about answering questions like that. And Laura and I have been talking about this for, it seems like, decades, right, Laura? Even though I know it's not, but the paper and pencil stuff just doesn't get it cut. It doesn't cut it. So, hey, is it mild cognitive decline? Is it depression? Is it, early onset Alzheimer's? And the answer is, I don't know. They're just filling out a bunch of stuff on paper. So that's really encouraging to know that this will allow for that. I know ERPs do too, which is part of my interest. Yeah. So segue over to you, Taylor. I noticed that you do cognitive assessments out of your clinic or practice. I'm not sure how you refer to it, but what are you doing for assessment? And then are you including, cues or anything else? What are you guys doing?
Yeah. So, so for myself, I am a psychophysiologist, not a psychologist. And my PhD is in psychology, but I have
not. Good for you. Good for you.
It helps.
So I have, some limitations there. I really just use the QEG. Eventually it will be the ERP. I use Cambridge Brain Science as well. And then just some, they have a lot of really good surveys on there for asking questions, in addition to our talk that we're having and figuring out what's going on from there. But for myself, since I'm not diagnosing, I'm really kind of just mainly looking for what's going on for that person's complaints, what we're seeing, and how we can target the training to meet those needs the quickest.
Okay. And so, not to minimize it by any means, but more of a screening for subsequent trainings or treatment.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And make sure there's not anything else that we're seeing, like we'll send it, if something looks like something else is going on, we'll send off to a neurologist or sleep lab, or, you know, just kind of being the gatekeeper for making sure if something else is going on, that's checked out.
The things you're talking about doing, I can just see how that would be more effective than maybe some of the referrals we get to answer certain questions where the folks functioning is being assessed from a different perspective, right? And I'm bagging on the paper pencil thing. There's some value there, obviously, but it's just encouraging to know that folks are out there. And so you're not calling yourself a psychologist and neuropsychologist or anything, but you're doing screenings and assessment on how folks' brains are functioning. And that's what Laura and I are supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Most people have, you know, bias, or they don't always aware of everything, you know? So it's like, what is that? How many times do you have to ask for if somebody hit their head to find out they hit their head? You know, is it like seven different ways you're supposed to ask, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They're like, oh, you mean that? Like when I fell down the steps. Oh, because I didn't really hit my head. I banged my shoulder. You know, like, yeah.
Yeah. And then I always like to tell people to like go on YouTube and look at a fresh dissection of a brain and see somebody hold a fresh brain and see how delicate it is just by holding it and then moving it over. And just by the weight of holding it, there's a whole indentation of the hand. And you're like, you just smash that in your head, you know, like there's going to be some repercussions of it.
It's Braunschweiger. That's what I thought of when I did a dissection class. It's the consistency of Braunschweiger.
Yep.
So
you do a fresh dissection or one that was formaldehyde.
Formaldehyde.
Yeah. I've never done a fresh one, but if you look on YouTube, you can see the fresh ones, and they're just the brain is so fragile. Delicate. It's really amazing. Yeah.
If you put a brain on that's not formaldehyde fixed on the edge of a counter, and go home and come back the next day, it's all flat and deflated, and there's a pool of water on the ground. You know, it doesn't like gravity. It likes to float in fluid, assuming your brain isn't leaking the fluid like mine is.
When you dissect, you have to dissect with a blunt end of the scalpel. You can't use the sharp end. It'll just crumble.
Taylor was at a brain dissection course that I set up. It's not that easy to get a human brain. You don't order them on Amazon, you know, and they don't ship them UPS. When something says, you know, human biological specimen on the box, not everybody wants to pick the damn thing up. So it's expensive. It costs quite a few $1,000s to put on that. And I bought a high resolution a video camera and suspended it on a jib boom above the brain and projected it like 20 feet tall on the wall behind, so people in the class could actually see what was going on. And I looked and looked and looked for the picture of Taylor and some of the students, but I've got all these pictures of the brain. I don't know why, you know. But there were some really cute pictures of people in the class. Taylor and some of them were all dressed up and makeup and, you know, all fancied up for the course. You know, you're going to go play around with a formaldehyde brain and you're all dressed up, you know. So, but it was, I think, a very educational full day brain dissection workshop. Everybody got to dissect a pig brain, but we prosected a human brain as a demonstration. The dissection is a prosection. And again, with high resolution video. And everybody got that video on a thumb drive. It was like 52 gigabytes on the thumb drive for the video. But that course went well. And Taylor's also been, I don't know how many years it's been now, but every week for an hour going over raw EEGs with a group. So, it takes time and focused energy to gather the knowledge to understand what the brain is doing. And you don't just take a weekend wonder workshop and end up with a skill set. It takes time and dedication, and Taylor's done that.
I always, whenever my clients, I try to explain things about the report and they want to understand more. And they're like, this is confusing. I'm like, yeah, it is really confusing. losing. It's, you should have this feeling because, you know, I think like, you know, when I came into the first time I met Jay, he was teaching, and I came in with years of experience of body work. My undergrad was in psychology, kinesiology, holistic health. I came in with a pretty good knowledge, and I still had no idea what I was looking at when Jay was, you know, looking at a QEG for the first time. And so it just takes so much work learning. It's never ending.
Yeah, it's it's an impossible learning curve with no top. It's very steep, but it's the right curve to be on. And it's good to see people that are earnest about their learning actually on that learning curve, you know, ratcheting up one little step at a time. So, you know, I keep telling people I'm actually kind of slow, but I've been in the field for 50 years, you know. just get a little bit every day, and after a while you've actually got a fairly good fund of knowledge.
I think using that that cap, we keep saying the Koreans, it's iSync media, right? You know, we got a
iSync brain, iSync wave, their database, the helmet, they don't have a product that's static. It's going to be in constant development. They have data that they haven't opened up to the norms yet. They collect the data up to 150 hertz. They analyzed up to 45. They have gamma 2 and ripples that they could analyze. They have ERPs, a bunch of different kinds of ERPs. They haven't executed that for normative analysis, but they have the norms. They have genetics, they have diet, they've got all of that for their normative group. So there's a couple of careers left for people to try and execute all of the data that they actually collected.
So everybody's talking about COVID because it's what we've been talking about for 2 years, and there's, you know, these secondary effects, I'll call them, which are significant. Folks are burnout and depressed and anxious and all these things that happen when we have to disrupt our lives for so long and maybe learn different ways and figure out how to, you know, operate without a concrete foundation under us. You know, things are different. So that's challenging, but there's some real effects that people are responding to too, right? Like things, shipping supply lanes are disrupted, and that changes and makes things harder. All these things that are real life impacts, I think, in mental health, we're all seeing those people somehow. But my question was more towards, are you seeing folks that are identifying, hey, yeah, like I'm a long hauler of COVID and this is what I'm experiencing, or a little controversial, but I'm seeing it in my practice where folks are like, hey, I wasn't great before, but I got my second shot. And now, boom, 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 I got this going on. So I'm more of the virus impact on functioning. Are you seeing that?
I actually do organized talks. I've given maybe 5 talks to various groups on long hauler COVID brain, how to identify it in the EG, QEG, and how to treat it. And I've got before COVID, COVID, and after treating long hauler COVID. So I've got, you know, longitudinal study from before COVID existed, the same brain now with COVID, and then the long hauler brain basically with COVID, and then after therapy to fix the problem. And we have a tool that can end up helping recover long hauler symptoms. There's lots of ways to end up with ischemia in the brain. And inflammatory changes is, you know, one of them. There's others as well, but inflammation is a major source of it. And if you have ischemia, the brain area that has it ends up not working as well. It's not like it can't work at all, but it's not working efficiently. So when you can't remember anything, your memory is just shot. Word finding and verbal fluency is gone. We can see that in the EEG, as the slow edge of alpha trickling down into the theta band. And you basically need to gently activate that area. The brain regulates its own blood supply. It will open the area up, but you have to turn the area on gently and leave it on. At that point, the blood supply to that area will open up. But very much like a head trauma, post-traumatic ischemia, you can't make a big demand for function or you cause further problems. You know, if you have impaired circulatory flow to an area, that's ischemia. And post-traumatic ischemia, migraine ischemia, COVID ischemia, whatever the source, if you put too big a demand for function on the and you exceed the blood supply capability of supplying it, you actually create hypoxia in the area, which creates edema. The edema creates pressure and it collapses the blood vessel further. So the head injury person doesn't get better if you put them back on the field right away. You have to rest that brain to make sure that you don't end up with cell death from the hypoxia, glutamate cascade and cell death. So, we can treat it effectively. We've got evidence of that, case series evidence of that, and very good outcomes with people. So I think the long hauler COVID symptom of brain dysfunction is something that we can treat quite effectively. There are other long hauler COVID symptoms that are cardiac related. That's not the kind of, post-COVID thing that we can fix with a head. There may be HRV things that can end up helping with that. That's not my area of expertise. So, but the, cognitive problems post-COVID long hauler, we can remediate that with training. It's not super quick, but it's faster than an ADD treatment.
Well, I actually wanted to say, in addition to what Jay was saying, with regards to neuroinflammation, specifically COVID, I think it's important to look at who the person was in terms of inflammation by the time they got infected with the virus, if not with any other kind of inflammation, because I think that largely influences how they get initially impacted and how they deal with the symptoms post-infection and how well they're likely to recover. I don't know what you think about that, Jay. I mean, I would tend to think that there might be some level of glial priming with COVID, the release of the inflammatory cytokines and chemokines and all the things that get released when you get infected. Therefore, considering neurofeedback plus other anti-inflammatory interventions like exercise and nutrition are quite important.
Yeah, you're not a disembodied brain. Last I knew, we don't just treat the brain. The brain actually is involved with the body. Anytime you're discussing cognitive function, if you're not looking at the body, you're missing the effect of the heart on the brain, the effect of the brain on the heart. Electrodermal, goodness sakes, the sympathetic outflow to the skin, eccrine sweat glands. Anna Weiss years ago had a matrix of cognitive function, and one axis was brain and the other axis was body. And the body was all measurements with electrodermal. And you've got a, if you've got a very active brain, but a very unactive sedate body, that's a different state than both of them being active. So you've got to actually look at the person as a whole, as a complete, not just a disembodied brain. I made that mistake early in my career. And one thing about making a mistake, you really learn from a mistake. I learn more from my mistakes than from what I do correctly accidentally. When you step in something, you end up with a common courtesy of a cowboy where I grew up. You say, don't step there. Try to guide other people around the error that you made. And I'm so old, I've made a lot of errors. So, I'm a reasonably good guide through the field to keep you from stepping in stuff.
Taylor, what's the best way for our listeners to learn more about you? What links can we put in the podcast notes for you?
Yeah, just, you know, my website, just at elitephysiology.com. That's probably the easiest. It has everything on there. So.
Okay, outstanding. Well, Taylor, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is great. Oh. Hey, we thank you all for listening to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. We'd like to thank our Patreon business supporters, Outrageous Baking. They're a dedicated gluten-free bakery that has been around for 15 years. Check them out at outrageousbaking.com. TorTalk wants more people to discover text-to-speech at tortalk.se. An alternative behavioral therapy, neurofeedback service in Vancouver, Washington. Just ask for Joshua M. We'd also like to thank our supporters, EEGME, Sadi M, Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell. And we'd like to welcome our new supporter, Loretta T. Hey, do you have an idea for a topic or a guest? Please email Pete at neuronoodle.com or leave us a voicemail with the link in the podcast notes. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And hey, if you really, really like us, please buy us a coffee on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. We love our Patreon peeps, don't we, Jay?
Absolutely. They get great coverage on this show, don't they?
Almost as good as that helmet. Cue the music.